You are tuned to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Your host Donna Wolf is sitting over there with a lovely smile this cold afternoon here in Kansas City.
Pretty chilly in Kansas City right now, Ebony. But we're all here, are going to warm the airwaves with some very, very pertinent information, courtesy of you. Thank you for facilitating our guests this afternoon, Ebony.
Yes, and Barry Jackson is live in the studio in full effect.
Hey, how's everybody?
And on the phone, we have Dr. Nashani Frazier, who is an associate professor of history at Miami University. She has taught courses such as Survey of U.S. History, African American History, United States in the 1960s, Feminist Thought, Civil Rights in the 1960s, and History and Practice. She's joined us to discuss her latest work, a book that she has out called Harambe City, the Congress of Racial Equality, or better known for some folks as CORE, in Cleveland and the Rise of Black Power Populism. Miss Nashani, thank you so much for calling in and joining us. We appreciate you for being on 90.1 FM here in Kansas City.
Thank you so much. I'm actually very happy to be with you all, although you didn't tell all my business. But yeah.
We got to kind of, set it up a bit here. But we so appreciate you taking the time to share with our audience as you are in another part of the country, but gratefully can call in from the telephone and share this insightful work that you've embarked upon. I do want to just give one of the things about your book that I thought was interesting. You referred to it as a monograph that explores the underlying conditions that led to Black Power's rise in CORE and Cleveland's relationship to this transition. Can you start us out by first defining what Harambe is, why you took that approach, and then giving us a brief history of CORE?
Okay. So I think the best way to approach it is to first talk about CORE, and then Harambe is a broader concept, and then how Harambe becomes a project of CORE.
Okay, thank you.
So what most people probably already know, the Congress of Racial Equality is formed in 1942, and it is considered an interracial organization co-founded by interracial group in Chicago. It transitions in the mid-1960s to an organization that is primarily mostly white and then mixed with African-Americans to a predominantly black organization. And CORE got a reputation in the civil rights movement for believing in interracial brotherhood for real, as they say. And that was, people's sort of tongue-in-cheek comment for referencing the ways in which a number of members of CORE, both black and white, had interracial marriages, right? So CORE, conceptually, had always been seen as an interracial organization, nonviolent, practicing Gandhian approaches to protest. However, what I talk about in my book is that there's a great deal more complexity to CORE than this sort of real belief in interracial brotherhood. That the moment black members enter CORE, even as early as the 1940s, there's this streak, this philosophy of black nationalism that emerges has always been a part of black people's ideological thinking, right? Integration, accommodation, black nationalism, this has always been a part of black leadership and approaches to how we attain our freedom. So black nationalism didn't just go away because CORE was an interracial organization. It was there from the very beginning. And what I do is chart how it seems very small, very almost an aberration in the 1940s, and how that eventually grows and begins to impact the national organization, pushing it toward Black power. And members of Cleveland Corps, who actually also happen to be my family members, play a pivotal role in that process of Corps turning to Black power. In that process of turning to Black power, a key part of Corps' decision-making revolved around how to go about obtaining freedom for Black people, empowerment for Black people, while not engaging in direct action protests. We decided to move away from that and instead move toward community organizing. And they choose a number of cities, or cities they refer to as target cities, where they will do this Black power experiment. When they get to Cleveland, however, there's a little bit of a problem. You cannot deal with economic inequality and economic discrimination in a city that has no industry, no jobs, right? There can be no job discrimination if there are no jobs.
Yeah.
And this is what is happening across the board with a number of Rust Belt cities, not just Cleveland, Gary, Detroit. This is how you get the emergence of Black mayors. They're all dealing with cities that are in one level of crisis or one level of death, dying. And so Corps is not just trying to deal now with the question of inequality. They're trying to rebuild a whole city, reconstruct the city, and make it anew, make it livable for Black folks in the area. And this idea of rebuilding, of coming together to rebuild, is how it is that they come up with the project idea of Harambe. In fact, that's what Harambe is, to work together, to build up, to create. And so they named the project, their Black Power Project in Cleveland, Harambe. And that, of course, becomes the title of my book.
Beautiful. Donna, you have a question?
I did have a question for Nishani. In these political movements in America, it seems there's always been a difference in the roles that men and women play. How were women treated as an element of Corps' Harambe Project?
This is a beautiful question. I love that question. Corps is really interesting because what is happening on the local level sometimes differs from chapter to chapter and then from local chapter to the national level. The person who's running the Cleveland chapter of Corps happens to be my aunt, and her name is Ruth Turner. And Ruth Turner gained... I'm sorry?
Keep going. I think some feedback.
Okay.
No,
Ruth Turner gains a reputation for being a fierce, articulate speaker on behalf of Corps. And even when her leadership is questioned within the organization, not by virtue of her gender, but it's by virtue of her decision to go toward community organization versus direct action, she's able to move beyond that political fight. I'm actually being nice when I say move beyond that political fight. It was ugly, and she wins it. And she transitions from Cleveland chapter into the National Action Council, which is the advisory board for Corps. And as I say in the book, she becomes the equivalent of the Black Power boogie woman. A lot of people view her as wielding too much power, and particularly being the key person to move Corps toward Black power. Now, that's actually not true. There are other people who are moving Corps toward Black power, but she's such a seminal figure in that process that she gets a good portion of the blame. I'm sort of putting quotes around that from the perspective of folks who felt disaffected from Corps' transition into Black power. So at least for the Cleveland chapter, to be sure, there's a lot of support for women's power. As I go beyond the Cleveland chapter, if you look at what happens in, say, Tallahassee, Florida, you have the Due sisters, Patricia Due, and her sister. They have a powerful influence in that chapter. The New York chapter before it's taken over by Roy Ennis, the Harlem chapter in particular, is led by a woman. And so there are a number of women within the core chapters that have a powerful influence on both their local, their locales, and then the national organization. However, that doesn't mean that men in some chapters are not vying for position, and it does not mean that they don't have gendered positions about who should be among that leadership. Roy Ennis being one, he has a men's caucus inside of the Harlem chapter of CORE, and argues rather aggressively that CORE should be under black male leadership. And then there was some circumstances of individual crass behavior where men would assume that women played a role in the movement that, that was not just about being an activist, but your activism included sexual favors to men as a kind of revolutionary service, if you will, within the organization. Now, that was not a national CORE position, but you certainly could see that in a number of chapters. But surprisingly, women had power in unique kinds of ways, and I think we have to sort of broaden how we think about women's power. A lot of people assume that women's power is just about having leadership in the organization. However, Ruth Turner was the secretary inside of the national organization, and she sort of took hold of that position, claiming, you know, she would do her best to be a pencil pusher, right? Well, she was more than a pencil pusher, and she used her affiliations, her network, her relationships to put people like Floyd McKissick in place for chairmanship of the National Action Council or the National Advisory Board of CORE. So women's role varied within CORE and didn't always look the way we presume leadership should look like, right, in terms of chapter at chapter leadership. But they certainly wielded power, and were not afraid to do so.
Nishani, in one of the interviews that you generously share on your Harambe City website, you mention there is a one lady who, at the moment, I don't recall her name, but there is a discussion on what black power is, and are some people considering, well, it's only going to be black people that need to do what we need to do to move ourselves forward or for our own equality. But specifically with CORE, obviously it's starting out as an interracial group of students from the University of Chicago. Black power is the aim, but there is not with just black people. So is that in your research and in your history that you reviewed, how are people defining black power within the CORE organization?
Now, I think that's very interesting. The bottom line is black power meant different things to different people, from organization to organization, from member to member. Inside CORE, there were multiple efforts to define black power. And initially, black power within CORE did not include the exclusion or did not act to exclude white membership. However, white members did feel as if there was no longer a place for them. That was not articulated by the leadership of CORE. What their argument was is that black power was an assertion of self and leadership and pride. And as an assertion of self, leadership, and pride, in order for a group of people to lift themselves up, they have to assert their own leadership, their own right to determine or to self-determine the direction in which they would go. White people could not play a role in that determination. Now, white people could serve, right? If you were willing to serve under black leadership, then there was a space for you. And there were white people who were prepared to serve under black leadership, and not just prepared to serve, but believed similarly to other black power advocates that it was really important. It was an important process of self-empowerment to have black leadership. So you have people like the Reverend Bruce Clunder, a white minister in the Cleveland chapter of CORE, who actually died fighting for the end of segregation. You have people like Stuart Wechsler, who worked for the Baltimore, was first in East River Corps and then in Baltimore. So there are some white members of Corps who were prepared to support Black Power as a concept of Black leadership. It's not until Roy Ennis enters into the picture that white members of Corps are officially banned from the organization.
Oh, so they were officially banned from the organization. That's interesting. Wondering,
yes,
this,
but
this
that's
is,
only under Roy Ennis.
Under Roy Ennis. Wonder when the Congress on Racial Equality began to deal with economic equality, and did it ever begin to include the economic issues in its platform or process of seeking Black Power?
Yes, ma'am. Well, one of the things I really want to point out is that, you know, often we presume that when we think about the Black Freedom Movement, it's a push for social and civil rights. There's always been an economic element to the movement. When you look at Montgomery bus boycott, their demands included more jobs for Black drivers, right? So this is not an issue that was far away from Black folks' psyche when it came to the idea of freedom. I'll give you another example. The March on Washington, the full title of the March on Washington is the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, right? So there was always this notion that economic equality was a part of freedom. For CORE, they first started to sort of deal with the issue of economic equality in two ways. First, the exclusion of African Americans from unions, and then second, with regard to tenant strikes. Where they utilized the money, or they used the money as a tool to force landlords to change slum conditions in homes. So they're dealing with the fact that there are poor working class folks or poor people who are dealing with circumstances around housing, and they're dealing with people who are could be classified as upper working class folks who could join a union. But they determined by 1964-65 to turn their full attention to economic development. And that's something that's happening across the board, but it's also happening specific to Cleveland because of the slow decline of industry in the area. Hello?
Thank you. No. I was looking to, I didn't know if Donna wanted to follow up there.
Well, you go ahead with your question, Ebony.
Okay.
That's fine. Go ahead.
Sorry about that.
I can add more.
Okay.
Because, of course, Pomabe City is all about economic development.
Well,
I don't know if you'd like me to expand on that.
Well, sure, but I also want you to talk about Black Power today.
Mm-hmm.
How does it manifest itself today, if at all? And, you know, that's, I guess, sort of the legacy of CORE and Harambe City movement.
Oh, I absolutely. Black Power, I actually wrote a short piece a couple of months ago titled The Return of Black Political Power. You see the election of people like Ross Baraka, Chukwuma Lumumba Jr., senior and junior. There's a new mayor in Birmingham. There's an African-American sister. I'm going blank on her name. But she was just recently elected mayor of Minneapolis, right? And so there is a Reverend, Dr. Kima Levy-Pounds is her name. I know it'll come to me in a minute. All of these mayors have been elected on a platform that is very similar to what we saw from Black Power in the 1970s. And I want to make a distinction between Black mayors from 1970s, what we see in between that period, and what we see now. it's not just a function of being elected as mayor of an all-black town. There's a particular sensibility about economic development and how one goes about economic development that has an element of activism to it that connects 1970s and Harambe City with what you see with black mayors and what they're doing now. A lot of these new black mayors are very direct in making it clear that they intend to challenge things like housing inequality, gentrification, or as the Coleman Jr., who's one of the folks who ran for mayor in Detroit, unfortunately lost, they're challenging this Negro removal, which was funny that he used that term. It comes straight out of the 60s and 70s as a way of describing the way big businesses and cities decide that they want to take over black communities and neighborhoods, and they want to use that space for development of the city. And so it's become clear for a lot of the current black mayors that there's this removal of black people in order to have space to facilitate the city and the economic engines within cities and to serve incoming white residents who now don't want to travel and do the suburban life, right, that they did in previous years, to want access to these new neighborhoods because they're closer to the city.
Nishani, we're gritting over here.
Sounds like Kansas City, just saying.
Gentrification.
Well, you can because you know that's my thing right there. So, there's no question that there is a direct tie. But I also want to point out that these new black mayors, they don't miss words. And this is distinct. If you think about what happened, say, in Atlanta, with there were a number of black mayors in Atlanta, and you think about what happened with the Olympics, where you had mass removal of homeless people, messing around with the black community and neighborhoods, and this was coming from black mayors. These mayors were not bound by black political sensibility, not in any way. They were kind of sort of the way in which people talked about, Barack Obama maybe being a post-racial notion of political, of black politicians. And so you have this post-racial group that are now being pushed out by this new set of black mayors. And they're very clear. If you look at Chokwe Lumumba Jr. in Jackson, Mississippi, they directly say, we are creating and modeling a city that is designed to be a radical city that's a challenge to capitalism, a challenge to racism and inequality. They say it straight out. You would not hear that from some of these other folks. So there's definitely a connection between the Harambe City and black power of 1970s and what we see coming out right now.
Nishani, as I'm just rethinking capitalism and our choices for what we call an economy, I wonder, is race necessary for capitalism to survive? This idea that some of us are called black and some of us are called white, and, you know, the concept of racism itself, to me, it undergirds capitalism. And how the necessity for some people to have more and a group of people to have a lot less, and just the way things are functioning from my observation. I'm not a historian like yourself, but just in your research and us as a people and different things that we've tried to do and groups like CORE and these innate rights that we have continued to fight for in America, in the United States of America, or is it, sometimes I just wonder, is it something that are we missing something? Are we trying to be a part of a system that doesn't work for us and we need to think a different way about it? Or I don't know. I'm just wondering, what have you seen even through this work and then just through your work in general, looking at history and you know, and us just trying to, sometimes I feel like we've spent so long just trying to survive, or just, you know, our basics, mm-hmm. our not just thriving, but even our, for most of us, our basic rights, you know, the, as, things you've talked about, and I was recently watching a documentary on the Black Panthers, and just, you know, their 10-point plan and what they want. We're their basics, food, you know, shelter, good education, good jobs, these same principles. And
we have the right to bear arms in form of militia.
Right. Mm-hmm. But what... I guess just the thinking of, okay, what is it that stops us? Who is the gentleman that he left and he wanted to, with the Black Panthers, and he wanted to form a soul city? And
yes, Floyd McKissick. He was mm-hmm. part of CORE and went to Soul City.
Yeah. So what has happened, I guess, in our history that you've seen, maybe parallels or opportunities to where, as we attempt to integrate into this system, that it doesn't really seem to really work for us as a whole, you know, as a core. Like, some people, okay, have overcome, but very, very few have attained some of those basic things that we're talking about as rights for us to have as humans.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Soul City. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, but my parents moved to North Carolina when I was 2 years old, and they actually moved to North Carolina because they wanted to go live in Soul City. Part of why I even wrote this book is I do have an affinity for these kinds of things, not just as an intellectual and a follower, as they say, but as a person who... family lived this in a real kind of way. I think that when we talk about racism and capitalism, it is something that is both woven together and running separately at the same time. When the police beat you across the head, you know, this whole question of capitalism is not really what's in play. It's this question of power and presumptions about what you can do as a white person to a black person. Now, certainly, capitalism has helped to facilitate that kind of thinking, but I think that's something that is constantly throughout history, sort of weaving in and out together, running separately and together apart, all at the same time. And I think that there have been people who have been aware that we've got to think about this whole question of the nature of capitalism. Within CORE, that issue, that same conversation that you are raising right now, it's so funny, you're like, you know, not that you're a scholar. I was like, no, everybody is having this debate. Can we talk about uplifting the black community and still do it within the space of this society, which by its economic nature must have someone at the bottom and someone at the top, and for the longest time and continuing to be so are black people who are at the bottom?
Yes.
And you have folks like, Sonny Carson, who was a member of Brooklyn CORE, who was very angry with Cleveland CORE chapter members because they were attempting to do economic development, but they would not, from his perspective, they would not let go of capitalism. From the perspective of folks from Cleveland chapter, they felt that it wasn't an issue of whether one could operate outside of capitalism. From their perspective, capitalism was, is, and always would be a part of American society. And so their belief is that one could bend the capitalism, massage it in such a way so that you could have mass participation or broad collective wealth and ownership in production or manufacturing within the community. So that's what actually Columbia City was about. It was a two-pronged approach. First was a political approach to help facilitate the election of Carl B. Stokes, who does eventually become the first black mayor of a major urban city. But the second element was to create companies and spaces where poor folks could through either sweat equity or a down payment, purchase stock in business, in businesses and companies, and that it sort of begin the process of wealth building. For example, Huff Area Development Corporation in Cleveland, Ohio, took some of the ideas of CORE, purchased the McDonald's, and the intent was that employees would own stock within the McDonald's, but also members of the community, the poor community there with Huff, would be able to purchase stock in that McDonald's so that you would have group wealth and group ownership. And there are some people who are moving in that trajectory. If you look at what is happening in Jackson, Mississippi, with Chokwe Lumumba Jr., they came up with this idea of collective ownership, and in fact, is a key element to their political activism and engagement there. You have collective ownership through green technologies, collective ownership in terms of food production, collective ownership in terms of housing cooperatives, child care cooperatives. So, different, a little bit different from what CORE does in Cleveland. Their whole vision begins with community ownership of the means of production in Jackson, Mississippi. This is something that they're currently working on. It's not something that's still up and running and everybody owns everything. It's a process. So I think there's always been this constant struggle to deal with the nature of capitalism as a laborer-owner style relationship, and the sense that black people will always be laborers, whether it's from slavery on to Jim Crow or the current prison system where they're being used as laborers, right, for capitalism. Or can you do something with capitalism, right? You, from there, you can't break it, so can you do something else, maneuver around it, through it, above it or under it, to have a more of a socialist approach, perhaps, which is, it doesn't necessarily leave out capitalism, but at least does something that allows people to have some access.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't leave us out. It at least makes us inclusive in a way that can be beneficial to us. I want you to speak a little bit to one of the things that you talk about in your book, is challenging previous assertions by historians that said that the leadership with CORE rubber stamped Richard Nixon's black capitalism concept. Can you speak to that a little bit? First, what was Richard Nixon's black capitalism concept, and then the challenges that you have with other historians?
Right. Well, of course, most people see Richard Nixon as the devil incarnate. And Richard Nixon, his administration was more of a two-headed hydra, where you had liberal folks who were in the administration along with conservatives. And depending on who was more convinced, that Richard Nixon would go one way or the other. So they managed to convince him that you've got to find ways to support black expectations of freedom, of gaining equality. And so he thought, you know, one of the ways that he could get on board was with this economic idea. And so he began to listen to civil rights leaders, including people from CORE, talk about this economic idea. However, what Richard Nixon heard and what CORE meant were two different things. CORE meant economic development. Richard Nixon heard capitalism, just black. And that was something, as a Republican, he could get behind. And most historians presume that that working with Richard Nixon, that the economic development portion just fell to the side in what CORE leaders were trying to do or what other black leaders were trying to do was just black capitalism, where you just replace one owner at the top with somebody who's black, who's effectively acting in the same vein as a white person who is suppressing black people, right? But now you just have a black face doing it. That was not their intent at all. And even within the Nixon administration, there was a conflict about this whole black capitalism versus economic development. And there was this language called expanded ownership. And it was rhetoric created from the liberal side within the administration that looked at employee-owned stock and businesses, had actually researched democratic countries that utilize cooperative economics, right? They wanted a model for how to do economic development, cooperative economics. They focused on organizations that were working towards that goal. They thought about Soul City as a black business. And by the way, Richard Nixon supported Soul City. Of course, in return for it, McKissick supported Richard Nixon. That did not go over well with a lot of people, to say the least, because, well, it's Richard Nixon. And so I actually talk about in the book that some of the ideas that are coming from this black leadership, even though it was considered good ideas, it was still the equivalent of this sort of Cosby Show, you know, steak and potatoes on a trash can lid, right? It didn't matter how good the dinner was. Richard Nixon was serving it up, and it was never going to be accepted. And that's what happens, right? There's this distinction and division between how black freedom is conceived within the economy. Is it economic development or is it black capitalism? And Richard Nixon runs down the road with black capitalism, moving away thoroughly from the idea of this economic development, with the exception of Soul City. The Soul City gets trashed by conservatives from North Carolina, namely Jesse Helms, who used to get on television and refer to black people, as the older folks would say, he referred to black people as chicken Indians on TV in the 1960s. And he hated Soul City, the very idea of Soul City. Mm-hmm. He did everything he could to misrepresent Soul City, claimed that it had abused funds and misappropriated funds. And even though Soul City was cleared from that, it effectively killed the kind of financial support they were getting both from the administration and from private companies. So I do think it's important that historians begin to delineate what is happening within the administration with this idea of expanded ownership and then this idea of black capitalism. And then really think about what black leaders intend, not what Richard Nixon does with those intentions, because those are two separate things.
You know, Shani, I've had several, you know, thoughts during the conversation about capitalism. And one of the things I thought about was the Montgomery bus boycott, when black people refused to use bus systems in Montgomery, Alabama. Mm-hmm. And formed their own transportation system ad hoc. I don't think the Montgomery bus boycott should have ever ended. I think that they should have continued with that idea of ownership of their own transportation system and built it and used it. And then if other folks wanted to buy a token and ride on the black bus, then that would have been fine. I think that was a missed opportunity. I also thought about Marcus Garvey and his UNIA, United mm-hmm. Negro Improvement Association, which sought economic ties with Africans in America and Africans on the African continent, and sold mm-hmm. shares of stock and created a shipping line, the Black Star Line, which incidentally came before the White Star Line, and the Titanic was a part of the White Star Line. But anyway, there was the Black Star Line. But of course, Marcus Garvey was, what, convicted of mail fraud and jailed yes. and deported and all of that. My other thought was about the idea of capital in America and the fact that the greatest amount of capital in America was black people. Was enslaved black people. That is the basis mm-hmm. and the foundation of capitalism in the United States. So mm-hmm. to Ebony's question, no wonder there's a link between racism and capitalism in America, because mm-hmm. the enslaved free labor, stolen labor of black people is the foundation of capitalism in America.
Oh, you're absolutely correct on that. And just to sort of talk about sort of black businesses I will say that one of the things that stood out for me that was interesting, and I think is right now something that black mayors are failing to do, is that a component of Harambe City was to craft relationships, export-import relationships with Africa and Asia. And in fact, one of the elements of the Harambe City proposal was to import Japanese televisions and other electronics into the United States. And that to me is the most fascinating thing, because I think if that was something that had in any way been successful, the amount of money that CORE and the Hub community would have gotten would have been incredible when we think about all the things that are owned by Japanese companies now, right? From cars to things like Sony and all these other things. And so there's no question that I think part of our limitation in thinking about economic relationships is that we limit it to our relationship to the United States in one way or another versus moving beyond the borders of the United States and crafting direct relationships with communities all around the world. And I don't mean just people of color, right? When we start to talk about some of the eco-villages that Jackson, Mississippi is trying to create, if you look at places like Germany, other places like Scandinavia, they're looking to create partnerships with cities in the United States who are willing to embrace this idea of ecologically sustainable cities and towns. So we do have to get beyond this idea that we're limited or somehow confined, that black power is not possible unless there is some sort of broader coalition with white people in the United States. That's not correct. And in fact, at least Harambe City pointed the direction to other possibilities. But I also think that is a reality that the black community also has to be very careful in creating protections in place for businesses that are created, because it's not just a function of having your own business. And I'll give you an example. You have Shenandoah Toys, which is created from CORE in California, and it's the first phenotypically correct African-American doll that is created in the late 1960s. And it's pulled women from the area who are on welfare to become workers in this company. And the company becomes, the dolls that are produced become hugely, hugely popular. So popular that Mattel looks around and says, hey, we should do the same thing. And unlike this company, they have a larger distribution, they have a larger marketing, they have more money. And Shenandoah is basically pushed out and pushed down as an idea. Even though it's incredible what they were able to do, Mattel comes along and just basically swats it away. And so one of the things that I think is very interesting about what you see in Jackson, Mississippi, is that they put in their proposal defensive components to black businesses, economic development, and cooperatives, so that once these things get off the ground and it looks nice and it looks like, oh, this could be successful, that you don't have larger competition come in to push you out and upend the cooperative relationships that you've created in the community.
Yeah. We are on the line with Dr. Nashani Frazier, Associate Professor of History at Miami University, speaking with her about her recent work, Harambe City, the Congress of Racial Equality in Cleveland and the Rise of Black Power Populism. Nashani, we need to take a station break, but before we go on that break, can you please give our listeners the website address to where you share a lot of the information from the book and your research on Harambe City?
You know what? I wish I could tell you off the top of my head.
Oh, that's okay. I have it. I have it. I just wanted It's okay. I have it written here. I was just going to let you say it. But it is harambecity.lib. That's L-I-B. miami.edu. But again, it's Harambe City with Nashani Frazier. We're going to take a station break here on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, with the Urban Connection Show. Your host, Donna Wolf, co-host myself, Ebony Johnson, and Barry Jackson, again on the phone with Dr. Nashani Frazier of Miami University, sharing some insight and Black power and history and ideas with us. We'll be back after these messages.
Supporting KKFI, Folk Alliance International, presenting the 2018 Kansas City Folk Festival. Family-friendly with artists from around the region and around the globe, featuring headliner Mary Chapin Carpenter. Sunday, February 18th, at the Westin Crown Center in Kansas City. For information and advance tickets, kansascityfolkfestival.org.
What else is there but the voice inside your heart? Something tames.
Hi, everybody. This is Bill Sundahl. I just wanted to take a second to say thank you for all the support in the last pledge drive. And a special thank you to Californos in Westport and Meshuggah Bagels with locations all over town. They are sustaining our volunteers while they're doing the good work of keeping KKFI on the air. Thank you very much.
We are back here on 90.1 FM, the Urban Connection Show, here with Dr. Nashani Frazier, Associate Professor of History at Miami University, discussing her recent work, the book Harambe City, The Congress of Racial Equality in Cleveland and the Rise of Black Power Populism. And Nashani, you haven't heard much from Mr. Barry Jackson, but he does have.
Yeah, I was wondering what happened to him.
What happened to him? The women, you know, we just did what we, you know, we.
Don't worry, I don't. Don't worry, I didn't drop down to shoot, so, you know.
We didn't drop him. We didn't drop him down the chute. We let him stay.
Yeah. Anyway. Question I had, you know, in reference to the efforts to put together Soul City, and in talking with the Nixon administrator, which my understanding initially there was an attempt to interface with Lyndon Baines Johnson because of, you know, his work pushing through civil rights legislation, but I guess it would be, you know, because it would be that as it may, McKissick wound up trying to work with the Nixon administration. Would you say one of the pitfalls, I mean, I guess the question I have is, you know, would you say that this, the what happened with Soul City and the work with the Nixon administration was kind of a cautionary tale and who you try to work with?
Yes. You know what? Here's a couple of things that I think is interesting. First of all, even though the CORE becomes known with working for Richard Nixon, the truth of the matter is not only did CORE try to work with LBJ, but we have to remember that many people thought the Bobby Kennedy and his presidency was a done deal. And so they had actually long since begun working with Bobby Kennedy. And in fact, CORE had been under some financial pressures because of debt owed during civil rights activities. And it was actually Bobby Kennedy through the back end that helped provide some relief, helping to get some of their debt taken down and taken away. So the idea that CORE had, they fully expected that that was going to be something that would come to fruition under a Kennedy administration. And, of course, Bobby Kennedy had also been known for his bedside economic development, right? So it was actually a perfect relationship. Of course, Bobby Kennedy is assassinated. And so the question for CORE becomes, how are they going to raise a city? Or in the case of Floyd McKissick, how are you going to literally create a city, right? So it's not even a question where Cleveland exists and you already have infrastructure in place. You have no infrastructure in Warrenton, North Carolina. No pipes, no water, no none of all that kind of stuff. And I'm from North Carolina. I've visited Soul City. The what they're able to do in that Soul City is beyond sort of a city from the ground up. And so I would say that I don't know if I want to say it's a cautionary tale, because to the extent that Floyd McKissick was able to get a lot of money out of Richard Nixon and to get Soul City up and running, and Soul City was not only going to have these businesses, black-owned businesses, but he had employed ideas of cooperative economics in Soul City. It's not Richard Nixon that leads to Soul City's downfall. It's Jesse Helms that is responsible for Soul City's downfall. The problem is most people assume that if you take money from the devil, you are thus a minion and an evil consort, right? And Marion is your problem.
You owe the devil at least, if nothing
and
else.
I do understand the problem that people have with that. At the same time, I'm hard-pressed, particularly as somebody whose parents went to go live in Soul City, to denigrate what Floyd McKissick was able to do, even with the Richard Nixon administration, right, building homes. There are still some homes out there at Soul City. And they were able to get one of the businesses up and running. The complexity of what he's able to do, the utopian vision that he has, I think we need to take a look at that and think about how he was able to navigate an administration like the Nixon administration to do something on behalf of black people, despite of who Richard Nixon was.
Well, I don't remember the name of the documentary, but I do remember seeing one on the building of Soul City and from beginning to end, pretty much. Mm-hmm. It is my understanding that Floyd McKissick has been able to continue to live there or finish out his years?
Floyd McKissick passed away. Mm-hmm. And I would say that what ends up happening is that once Jesse Helms puts his hands on it, right, and the conservative rise happened, and I know this sounds deeply ironic, but Nixon is not the conservative in the Republican Party. It's people like Ronald Reagan Donald Rumsfeld, Jesse Helms, Pat Buchanan. These are people who are the true conservatives, and I'm being polite because they're just out and out racist.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who basically bring an end to Soul City as a concept. Floyd McKissick does continue to live and die in North Carolina, but I think it bears noting that his daughter is still living, and she is still trying to purchase property in Soul City and has had conversations with people about reigniting Soul City and thinking about ways that we could come back to it. I think that's been facilitated by a new documentary that came out last year on Soul City, a couple of books that have also come out on Soul City. So Soul City has not gone away, that's for sure.
Dr. Nashani, has the word or idea of reparations ever been associated with Soul City? Was that part of the concept?
Well, it's interesting that you note that, because when you look at Black Manifesto, right, and folks like I'm going totally blank, the brother from Detroit, Oh my God, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name like this. But, you know, he's an activist. But all of those folks were supportive of reparations as an idea. From the perspective of CORE, their position is using the language of reparations stops the conversation and inhibits your getting money from all these institutions. And so I think it's a question of language and rhetoric, right? Yeah. Where you have the Black Manifesto asking and people like Foreman outright asking for reparations versus CORE that's trying to get government funding. Well, you know, you want reparations, you want it from the government. CORE just simply says we want to utilize government funding for economic development, and so they're using a different kind of rhetoric to get the money to engage in the same process of economic development, cooperative economics, and Black uplift. Again, this is you know, me as a historian, I'm looking at this from both sides. I can tell you that I have a couple of colleagues who would challenge me on that and say that reparations is totally different. But I would say to them that reparations still depended on some outside entity outside of Black people depositing or giving the funds and monies to be used for whatever projects or programs that would empower Black people. So you know, for me, the issue is always about what is the ultimate motivation for any person who is trying to empower Black folks. And if you can see on the ground the ways in which that empowerment looks in a sort of pragmatic and or even a not pragmatic way, but you can see it, then I'm not willing to say that somehow they're traitors or they're disloyal, which is how CORE. But at the same time, however you want to see Floyd McKissick, Black people had a place to go. And Soul City was that place in the middle of nowhere.
Well, with that, Nashani, we'd like to thank you so much for joining us this hour. We have come to the end of our time, but for our listeners, we have been listening to Dr. Nashani Frazier, Associate Professor of History at Miami University. She is the author of Harambe City, The Congress of Racial Equality in Cleveland, and The Rise of Black Power Populism. There is a website associated with this book as well where she shares her research. We encourage you to take a look if you're interested. And Nashani, we appreciate you for calling in and spending part of your Saturday with us.
Thank you so much. And I really want to encourage people to go to the website. I just a quick point. I did create the website with the sense that I wanted people to have a sense about who CORE was without having to go read a big old book, nor purchase it.
Yeah.
Right? It's available and it's free. And I have teacher lesson plans on there. I have maps so people can understand why there's protests. So you don't have to have that book in order to understand why CORE exists and why it does the work it does and how economic development becomes a part of their Black Power project. So I certainly hope people will go to the website.
Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you all so much. Great questions. I hope I was able to answer everybody's questions.
You were. We appreciate it. All right.
Thank you.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not